Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war.
Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. We do have with us the director of the Drug Policy Project from the King County Bar Association, Mr. Roger Goodman. Roger, are you with us?
I'm here, Dean. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Yes, Roger, for those who may not have heard of this major resolution that you and many other organizations have put forward, tell us a bit about it, please.
Well, about 3 years ago, the King County Bar Association, along with the Medical Society and the State Bar and State Medical Association and the State Pharmacy Association, resolved that the war on drugs was a failure. And we made a little bit of news because it wasn't because the war on drugs being a failure is news. Everybody knows that. It was that these professional groups all of a sudden are speaking up about it. And so we got some attention. And we were able to get our state legislature here in Washington State to reduce prison sentences dramatically for drug offenses, to give judges a lot more discretion on a case-by-case basis, to order a treatment instead of incarceration, and a lot of funding was provided for drug treatment so that that could happen. So we made a lot of progress sort of on that level. But there was a criticism. Well, you know, this drug war is the only option. We don't have any other alternative. This is a vigilant fight. We're always going to have drug abuse. We're always going to have people trying to get this stuff, and we're just going to have to keep fighting this. And we paused and thought, well, you know, there might be another alternative, a more workable alternative. And so we've spent the last 3 years not only doing extensive research, and we published a report, and we'll get all the details about that, but we have enlarged the coalition. So we have the Washington Academy of Family Physicians. We have the Washington Society of Addiction Medicine, the doctors who are specialists in training for addiction medicine. We have the League of Women Voters, a civic group, very important civic group here in Seattle and I think all across the country. We have the State Public Health Association has endorsed the same resolution that we passed here at the King County Bar Association. And I could go on. The African American Bar Association. Lots and lots of professional and civic groups have come together to say, okay, there is a workable alternative, and that workable alternative to the war on drugs is a regulatory framework, something where the drugs are controlled rather than trying to control people. It's outrageous that in a free society, we are trying to chase after this problem, and in the meanwhile, leaving drugs up to the control of criminal narco gangs, and where kids have easier access to drugs than adults do. So we're sort of asking the simple question, do you want the bad guys to be controlling the drugs or the good guys? I mean, is it really that simple? So we passed a resolution, and these other organizations passed a resolution calling on the legislature to create a body of experts to get together. And in pharmacology and medical practice and education and treatment and all the folks who need to be around the table to make recommendations to the legislature about how a regulatory model can be implemented in Washington State to replace the failed prohibition model. So we're very excited about this.
And one member of this coalition that excites me, too, is that there are ministers involved.
Yes, the Church Council of Greater Seattle, a very broad group of religious institutions, they unanimously endorsed and passed their own resolution talking about how the current policy has failed, eroding public health, compromising civil rights, corrupting public officials, and so on. And that we need to move towards looking at a regulatory framework so that we can undercut the criminal element, protect children much better, and provide treatment to those hard-to-reach folks who, you know, that's really the problem if you think about it, as far as addiction is concerned. Since we criminalized addiction, those who are truly addicted are unable to benefit from the current policy because the current policy says unless you quit first, we're not going to help you. That, frankly, is cruel from a medical point of view. And so we're seeking to reach out to them, too.
Yes, sir. I felt quite proud when a Christian online radio station started carrying the Drug Truth Network programs, The Journey, online. And it is a point of compassion that rather than subject people to decades in prison, perhaps, that you help them seek a better life.
That's right. We've seen that the research shows very clearly, voluminous, persuasive research, that exposure to the criminal justice system, arrest, prosecution, incarceration, supervision, and then very likely re-arrest and re-prosecution and incarceration and so on, is counterproductive to solving the problem of drug addiction. And from the religious point of view, we need to give folks a chance at redemption, and we're not.
With this coalition, so spread that it is the stuffed shirts, I think you told me one time, of your community.
Right.
These are the people that perhaps would have been least likely to join this coalition. Let's talk about the evidence. What has brought them to this point?
I've also said that we're not a front for the fringy ponytailed pot smokers. You know, we've got these are legitimate objectives, and we've had the same objectives from the very, very beginning. The four major objectives are reduce crime, improve health, protect children, and save public money. And by any measure, the current failed war on drugs has not reduced crime. It has promoted more crime. It has not improved health. It has degraded health. It has not protected kids. Younger kids are using more and more dangerous drugs over the course of time. And it certainly hasn't saved money. We've spent, just in one example, we've spent $45 billion in the last 20 years trying to stop drugs at the border. And as a result, what's happened? We got the lowest cost on the street ever and the highest purity levels on the street ever. So it is an abject failure. So since those four objectives are not being met, protecting kids, reducing crime, improving health, and saving money, we've got to find another way. And so based on, you know, again, legitimate objectives and a lot of research, a lot of hard data that shows that there are other things happening elsewhere in the world that are working a lot better, this coalition of professional groups was willing to support this because, like I've been saying, it's so reasonable, it's radical. We want to save money more than anything else right now because we've got budget deficits. Doctors want more discretion. Doctors don't want the government breathing down their neck telling them how to practice medicine. Lawyers want the courts unclogged. More than half of our caseloads are basically petty drug cases. And so we can't make any money. You know, the lawyers have to wait in line for civil cases and other matters for years. And so it's bogging down the administration of justice. And then I guess just generally in a philosophical sense, there's been loss of respect for the law. When you look at a cop, what do you think? Well, I feel afraid. He's after me. And I shouldn't feel that way. When I look at a law enforcement officer, I should feel respect. I should know that he's going to protect me. But in fact, a lot of cities and law enforcement agencies have as their priority chasing after drugs rather than enforcing the laws that cause, to protect against harm to persons and to property. And so respect for the law has been degraded because these laws are widely flouted. And the third thing is, just as a lawyer speaking here, think about this. We've got hazardous substances that are left in the hands of a violent criminal market. It's a $500 billion business worldwide, so there's an unrelenting demand on a huge mass market for this. And the government has ceded authority, ceded control to the criminal gangs. They say, oh, well, if we stop the war on drugs, we're going to be surrendering. We've already surrendered. We've surrendered control of these hazardous substances to the nastiest people on the planet. So we want to put these narco gangs and these terrorists out of business. And so, you know, that obviously is going to create some ruffles here. You know, maybe we're going to have to wear flak jackets to protect ourselves because there's going to be some unemployment in those ranks. But really, ultimately, that's what we're talking about.
Now, Roger, you're talking about the violence. I don't know how much you track it, but in the border states down here, California and particularly Texas right now, there are members of these drug cartels, their hit squads, if you will, that are killing law enforcement officers on both sides of the border, that are killing journalists occasionally. Let's talk about how we've ceded that power and that money that makes this possible to these organizations.
Yeah, we actually report on this in our most recent report, and you need to get the website for your listeners. It's KCBA, King County Bar Association. Go to kcba.org. and you'll go to the Drug Policy Project, or you can go to What's New up at the top of the site there, and you'll see our latest report, which talks about what's going on the Texas-Mexico border, where, you know, plazas, public plazas are being turned into battlefields with grenade launchers. It's unbelievable. Journalists being assassinated and having to be silenced. And so this is basically what happens when you drive a market into the illegal realm. Because we've had just recently the killing of four Canadian Mounties, supposedly connected to a drug, a marijuana grow op. In fact, it was just 20 plants, and it was a deranged man, heavily armed, who had stolen a truck. So it was sort of misreported as a sort of drug-related gang killing. In any event, if you take a closer look, it really wasn't about drugs. It was a crazy guy with a lot of guns, and he happened to corner four Mounties and killed them all. And it's tragic, and murder must be punished, but this really doesn't have to do with marijuana. Ultimately, let's just say it was a grow operation, a major grow operation. It's important to acknowledge that marijuana in and of itself and all the other prohibited drugs are not the cause of the mayhem and the death associated with the war on drugs. It's the fundamentally flawed policy of prohibition that spawned these intractable problems. You know, we have this spread of bloodborne diseases, the clogging of the courts I was talking about, corruption of public officials is rampant. This is hauntingly familiar from the attempt to prohibit alcohol over 80 years ago. So we found here, again, using facts, not fear, that treating drug use as a criminal matter rather than a social and medical issue has just tragically failed. Failed to reduce drug use, failed to reduce the harms arising from drug use, failing to reduce public costs. And we keep saying we need new tools. We need new tools to fight the war on drugs. Well, we've been seeking new tools for decades now to fight a crime problem that has inevitably arisen from this policy of drug prohibition. And the crime problem has distracted us from addressing the problem of drug addiction itself. And so now it's time to turn to the drug problem, because it's been, you know, the crime problem's been getting in the way. And when it comes to the drug problem, it's the public health approach that works. Research, education, prevention, and treatment. Much more effective than trying to use criminal sanctions. And so it's drug prohibition, ultimately, that's been the major impediment to employing that public health approach. And so we say it's time to consider an exit strategy, a responsible exit strategy for the war on drugs. And we have set that forth in our comprehensive study, which, again, I commend your listeners to log on to kcba.org, King County Bar Association, kcba.org, and go to the Drug Policy Project, and you'll find this study, which lays out a roadmap for how we can limit access to drugs so that we don't cause a lot of harm, but not try to pretend like we're going to live in a drug-free society. Where, you know, you turn on the television and all these other mind-altering and pleasure-inducing and mood-altering substances that happen to be produced by the pharmaceutical industry are aggressively peddled at us. You know, it's a very dangerous fantasy to think we're going to have a drug-free society. We need to be real about this and save money and really kind of care for people rather than sort of chase them around.
How does one encourage, motivate, and get the listeners and those who might influence their legislators to speak up?
Well, you know, the legislature, whether it's the city council or, you know, your county commission or the state legislature, is always going to be behind the people. And that's actually how democracy is supposed to work. So it really is up to you, all the listeners, to take action and write, you know, transmit responsible, fact-based communications. Organize in your own area. It doesn't have to be a lot of people, as long as you're effective. And again, using facts and being respectful and inclusive and deliberate about it, not sort of trying to be all inflammatory, then the elected officials will respond. I really think that the democratic process works in this way, and the more folks get organized on the local level, and there's lots of information for you. You don't have to make anything up. There's all sorts of, you know, sample letters to the editor available on websites in the reform community, and the report that we just put out has 644 footnotes. So, you know, pick any one of those, and you can use it to substantiate points that you want to make. So we're here to help.
Now, Roger, as I understand it, last week you had a hearing before your Senate, I believe it was, and though it wasn't a slam dunk, it began a process. Let's talk about that process and how that's now perhaps affecting the city's discussion of the subject.
Yeah, what we did at the King County Bar Association and the other professional and civic groups I'm talking about, we passed a resolution, and the resolution called for the legislature to set up a body of experts. So we approached the state Senate and the state House, and in the Senate, before the period of the cutoff, when they aren't allowed to introduce any more bills, a bill was introduced to create such a state commission on psychoactive substance control, with a lot of organizations sitting around the table with expertise, including pharmacologists and doctors and law enforcement, because they still, law enforcement is going to have a continual challenge on their hands to control the gray market. The black market is exclusively produced and distributed illegally. The gray market is produced legally but distributed illegally. And so there's going to be diversion. People are going to want to gain access to drugs that are a little bit too harmful for the state to allow, you know, outright availability, but there would be availability to others who would qualify. So there's going to be some leakage, and there's always going to be, you know, there's going to be kids who get drugs. I mean, this is going to happen. We can't imagine we're going to have a perfect world. But controlling the gray market is a lot easier than the black market. And so folks would gather around the table and make recommendations to the legislature. The Senate heard this bill. There was an official public hearing on this bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. A very important hearing, because they were listening up. There were two or three, I'd say, relatively uninformed views from the panel of senators, but they were in the minority, and they sort of threw around terms like legalization and decriminalization without further defining what they mean, and also talked about the message to kids, which is something I love to talk about. What message are we sending to kids today? These are hazardous substances. Don't use them. Well, except we're leaving them up to criminal gangs so that you can get them really easily. You know, that's a mixed message if I ever heard one. Plus, you know, again, turn on the TV and you take a pill to get better. You have somebody running through a field of flowers. I mean, I don't even know what the drug is for, you know. Or you have to line up at the nurse's office to get your Ritalin because, you know, you're acting out, so we're going to feed you with drugs. There's all sorts of mixed messages we're feeding children today. And I think that, you know, those who are really afraid of radical change in policy are asking those sorts of questions without actually thinking about what the answers would be. So anyway, the Senate did have a hearing. It was an important hearing. I don't expect that the bill will progress further this year. But now is the beginning of a campaign. We have a report. We have institutional support for it. Each of the organizations in our coalition are coming on board. We have almost a dozen at this point, and it's going to grow. And then we're going to get into the Rotary Clubs, the churches, the PTAs, the Chamber of Commerce, you name it, and get the, and I mean, we're on the radio and in the TV and so on. So it's about changing the culture. And when the culture changes, the law follows naturally. So I don't have any doubts that the law would change, but our challenge is to change the culture. You know what? We changed the culture with cigarette smoking, and so we've been able to reduce tobacco consumption in half in order to reduce the adverse health consequences, and we didn't lock anybody up in the process. So there's a good example of using the public health approach to change behavior and to improve health without wasting money on the whole criminal approach.
Well, Roger, I want to once again remind folks, and I do highly recommend you visit their website. It is KCBA. That's King County Bar Association, kcba.org, and they do have some excellent information there that you can share with your local elected officials, your state and federal officials for that matter. It is data that stands on its own and is worth sharing. Roger, we just have a couple minutes left. Any points you'd like to make before we go?
Well, I just want to encourage folks who may be listening in Houston or in Honolulu or wherever you happen to be, that this is a national movement we're talking about. We're not just up here in crazy, flaming liberal Seattle. I am working now with bar associations in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Vermont, Oregon, New York, Wisconsin, all over the country. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones, Florida. And so nationally, public officials and opinion leaders recognize that this is a wasteful policy and we just can't afford it anymore, and that it really is time to talk about the elephant in the middle of the room. Yes, we need to fund treatment, and yes, we need to make the criminal justice system more therapeutic, but we also have to talk about prohibition itself and talk about the black market and how to protect kids better and how to clean up the streets by bringing those folks who unfortunately are left there indoors where they can be cured or healed or at least have their health stabilized. And so there's a very receptive audience out there, particularly because of the fiscal effects, the terrible waste of money. Down in Texas, I know there's corners of the state where there's a lot of hope that something like this can happen, and I'd be happy to come down to Houston. I haven't been there in a number of years, except through the airport recently, to talk to folks about this and get your community moving.
I would be honored to have you come down here and do just that. We'll see if we can make arrangements to make it happen. Roger, there's nobody much on the other side other than the paid staff, if you will, like the drugs are, who think this thing is functioning normally. Even the district attorneys, as I understand it, they're reluctant to engage you on this.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I was on a radio program earlier today here in Seattle, and they invited the DEA, the U.S. Attorney, the local police, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, which, by the way, is funded by the pharmaceutical and tobacco industry, ironically, and the Coalition of Anti-Drug Communities, I'm not sure what it's called, and all of them declined to make any comment, declined to appear, declined to participate. And so I guess folks are afraid of the facts over there. A lot of existential crisis going on because this is their daily work. This is their daily life. And so I understand, you know, when the rug's going to be pulled out, you're going to not have anything to stand on. But here in Seattle, we do have cooperation because this is the way we work. We try to build consensus. We're not pointing fingers at the police. As a matter of fact, we want to help the police. They need help more than anybody else. They've been given an assignment. They can't accomplish these objectives. The prosecutor wants to crank things down and be a lot more public health based, and so we're making progress with all sectors, even those who are prosecuting the war on drugs, at least locally.
Roger, thank you so much. That's going to have to wrap it up. We'll do this again soon.
Thanks a lot, Dean.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's time to play Name That Drug by its side effects. Dry mouth, asthenia, sweating, nausea, decreased appetite, somnolence, dizziness, insomnia, tremors, nervousness, ejaculatory disturbance, impotence, and male and female genital disorders. Time's up. The answer, Paxil. Don't get further depressed or panic, but the FDA just shut down the factory for failing to meet manufacturing standards. In an effort to be fair to the drug warriors who adamantly refuse to be on this show, this soundbite is reminiscent of what you might see should you visit the website of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Oddly enough, our reporter, Winston Francis, chose to start this with a quote from yours truly. Our guests range from judges to scientists, from warden to prisoner, all proclaiming the drug war a failure, a hopeless failure.
You will often hear this argument from drug legalization advocates, but the facts seem to be contrary to such pessimism. You see, according to Speaking Out Against Drug Legalization, a publication released by the Department of Justice, the drug war has reduced casual use, chronic use, and addiction, and prevented others from even starting using drugs. Overall, drug use in the United States is down by more than a third since the late 1970s. That's 9.5 million fewer using drugs. We've reduced cocaine use by an astounding 70% during the last 15 years. That's 4.1 million fewer using cocaine. According to a new survey by the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse, at Columbia University, almost two-thirds of teens say their schools are drug-free, and the good news continues. According to the Department of Justice, less than 5% of the population uses illegal drugs of any kind. Think about that. More than 95% of Americans do not use drugs. How could anyone but the most hardened pessimist call this a complete failure? The government uses the drug war to face the challenge of protecting its citizens from the shackles of addiction. Because who knows what you would do if you were free to choose what you put into your own body. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Drugs or Jesus? On the way home from Austin, I heard a song by Tim McGraw talking about Jesus or drugs. He's kind of vague about specifics as to which drugs, probably not the drug alcohol he is paid to endorse. I have known drugs to bring you closer to your God. I have also known some interpretations of God to be the cause of death throughout history. This is what the Bible says concerning marijuana. Genesis 1:12. The land produced vegetation. plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kind. And God saw that it was good. Matthew 15:11. What goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean, but what comes out of his mouth, that is what makes him unclean. We need to get the church right with marijuana, because throwing people in jail and destroying families isn't what Jesus would do. We have already had a few religious leaders come onto the show and let you know it's not right to perpetuate the Salem witch hunt or Spanish Inquisition. Won't you stand up for Jesus against this war on drugs? This is Steve Nolan for the Drug Truth Network.
The feds have issued a new report on marijuana and drug treatment. The drug warriors spin, more seek help for marijuana. But what's really happening? The data shows the number of people referred to treatment who reported marijuana as their primary substance of use has increased. More than half of those referrals were through the criminal justice system. Not surprising. Diversion to treatment, whether it's needed or not, is a popular alternative to incarceration. And during the time period studied, annual marijuana arrests doubled from 340,000 to almost 700,000 a year. Now let's dig a little bit deeper. Using a data analysis tool to crunch numbers from the original data files, we find that during that period, of all the people who reported marijuana as their primary substance, only 35.4% were given a diagnosis of cannabis dependence, 24.7% a diagnosis of cannabis abuse, and 21.7% of these patients were actually diagnosed with opioid dependence. Is it possible for people to abuse or become dependent on marijuana? Yes, but the questions are we directing help where it's really needed? And why criminalize a health problem and make it harder for people to get the help they need? For the Drug Truth Network, this has been Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
According to a new State Department report, U.S. occupied Afghanistan produced a record amount of opium last year. Surging past the prior peak under Taliban rule, U.S. occupied Afghanistan now produces 17 times more opium than second place Myanmar. The report says that, quote, Afghanistan's illicit opium heroin production can be viewed, for all practical purposes, as the rough equivalent of world illicit heroin production, and it represents an enormous threat to world stability. Meanwhile, the unlikely suicide of Army Specialist Juan Torres has called attention to rumors of rampant drug activity by American military personnel at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. Also, questions linger about a new round of aerial spraying reported in Afghanistan by the New York Times. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
Okay, a couple of program notes before we go. We don't have any new stations to report, but I understand there are a couple of stations that are giving us a trial right now, and I want to recommend that those are who are listening in, contact the program director. Tell them they need to carry the Drug Truth Network shows on a regular basis. Next week, our guest will be Mr. K. He's the Drug Truth Network reporter who just got out of prison after serving 14 months for having urine with one part per million of THC. And as always, I remind you that because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. And I ask you, please, my friends, be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.